Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Compliance Week News podcast. I'm Matt Kelly, editor of Compliance Week, and today we want to talk about the perils of giving the Upjohn warning during internal investigations. Now, the Upjohn warning is akin to the Miranda warning police must give to people under arrest. It's where corporate counsel are supposed to give the Upjohn warning to employees to remind them that corporate counsel represents the company, not them personally, and that anything employees say during investigation could later be used by regulators or prosecutors for enforcement against them personally. Now, the Upjohn warning is in the news right now because recently we've seen a federal judge in California rule that a company failed to give a proper Upjohn warning to its CFO during an internal investigation over stock option practices. When that investigation later became an SEC probe, the CFO argued that he didn't know what he was saying during the investigation might wind up putting him at risk during an SEC enforcement action. Now, to talk to us about all of this is John Grugan. He is a partner in the litigation and compliance practice at the law firm of Ballard and Spahr. So, John, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure.
Now, first question. This California decision is just the latest in, I guess, a small outbreak of rulings that touch on the Upjohn warnings. Why suddenly are we seeing this flare up in the news?
Well, Matt, there's no question that there has been a fair amount of attention recently on Upjohn warnings, and I think the reasons for that are twofold. Mm-hmm. First, over the past several years, and certainly since Enron and the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, there's been a far greater focus on corporate liability. The government is especially attuned to earnings management and to corporate policies that the government contends amount to self-dealing among senior executives. And this focus certainly was true several years ago. The stock options backdating prosecutions that garnered so much attention over the past several years is one example. And that focus obviously is not going to diminish in the current environment. As a result, audit committees and boards of directors now are much more likely to respond to concerns about internal wrongdoing by requiring an internal investigation. In addition, they frequently look to outside counsel to conduct the investigation and to ensure that there's no suggestion later on, whether by shareholders or the government, that the investigation was compromised in some way or that the result was preordained. This increased focus on appropriate responses by audit committees and boards of directors is due not only to their obligations under Sarbanes-Oxley, but also to the reality that companies stand to benefit substantially by cooperating with the government. If a company uncovers wrongdoing on its own and reports the results of its investigation to the government, it may receive substantial credit in terms of reduced fines, declinations of prosecution, and other beneficial treatment by the government, even if the company conducts an internal investigation after receiving a government subpoena or a notice of investigation. It still may receive many of those same benefits by cooperating. Mm-hmm. But, and this is the second reason, the benefits of cooperating frequently turn on holding the attorney-client privilege. If Upjohn warnings are provided and the company holds the privilege and as a result no employee or other individual mutually holds the privilege, the company may freely seek the benefits of cooperating with the government. If, however, an employee also holds the privilege, that person's consent must be obtained before lawyers can go and demonstrate the company's cooperation by disclosing the results of the internal investigation. And that's why the issue of who holds the privilege is so critical.
So now we have seen a couple of rulings about this, and so let me say I'm the corporate counsel and I'm helping regulators by doing an investigation. What's the best procedure here for me to give an Upjohn warning? Now, I had said it, you know, it's akin to a Miranda warning I'd see on Law and Order, but is it really that simple, or is there a more thoughtful thing you should be keeping in mind as you're giving these warnings?
Well, there certainly is a more thoughtful thing that you should be keeping in mind when giving the warnings. And it's really interesting that you phrased the question that way. You said that you were helping regulators with an investigation. As you know, as the general counsel of a company, your obligation is to the company and not to the government. But many times you may conclude as general counsel that the best way to serve your client's interest is to have the government know that you want to get to the bottom of everything as much as the government does and that you'll let the government know what you find. In effect, by taking over the investigation, you may help the government decide that it has someone responsible and credible conducting the investigation, that nothing will be withheld from the government, and that the government should not dedicate its limited resources to this investigation. Instead, you will handle it. And that's an easy decision to make in some cases, like where you have a robust compliance program and insider trading policy in place, but a rogue employee is suspected of insider trading. But in many other cases, you probably will need to conduct some portion of the investigation before you, as general counsel, conclude that it's in the company's best interest to cooperate with the government. Now, to get to your question, every lawyer has to follow a number of ethical rules that give some of the answer as to what interviewing lawyers must say. Lawyers who represent companies must act at all times in the company's best interest and must act whenever he or she discovers that an employee has or intends to act in a way that would be harmful to the company. Also, lawyers dealing with unrepresented parties cannot imply that they are disinterested. Lawyers representing companies must tell unrepresented parties that they represent the company's interests. And so as a result, the best procedure is to give the Upjohn warnings at the beginning of each interview as a routine matter and to ensure that the witness understands what you have said. The Upjohn warnings that you provide should, at a minimum, disclose to the witness that you represent the company and not the witness, and that what the witness discloses will be passed on to your client, which holds the privilege in its sole discretion.
Mm-hmm. Is the actual language for this fairly standard and well understood now for the non-lawyers who might be listening to this and who might not be familiar with exactly what the Upjohn warning says? But is the language itself clear enough?
It is and it isn't. It's not nearly as clear as the Miranda warnings that you hear in Law and Order, but You have to communicate effectively, and by that I mean that the witness needs to understand that what is told to the interviewer does not create an attorney-client privilege, and that the holder of the privilege is the company and not that employee.
Now, let me flip this perspective around here, and let's say I am the executive being deposed or being interviewed in an investigation. The company later waives privilege after I give some information. Am I now at legal jeopardy? And I guess what I'm wondering is if executives really need to start thinking about their own personal liability from day one, and if they should be calling up their personal lawyer every time the general counsel asks them to swing by the office.
Well, that's a really, really excellent question, and that's one that is at the heart of the decision that you mentioned at the outset of this podcast. Typically, for litigators listening to this, it's not like a deposition that takes place. There's no court reporter. There's no one who administers an oath. But you're right to ask about this because the interviews and the warnings that may be provided can lead to liability not only for the witness but also for counsel. And I'll tell you about a case that's illustrative of this, and it is sure. United States v. Nicholas, and it's from the Central District of California. That case arises out of the Broadcom investigations and prosecutions that related to the company's practice for granting stock options. In May 2006, Broadcom retained outside counsel for three purposes: to conduct an internal investigation, to represent the company in its dealings with the government, and to represent the company and its officers in two shareholder suits. In June 2006, the outside lawyers met with Broadcom's CFO to interview him about the company's stock option grant practices. Before the interview began, the lawyers did not tell him that they represented only the company and not him, or that what he told them would be communicated to the company and possibly third parties, including the government. The CFO accordingly discussed Broadcom's stock option grant practices with the outside lawyers. The SEC and the Department of Justice both opened investigations into Broadcom's practice for granting stock options, and after the interview of the CFO, Broadcom decided to cooperate with the government and disclose the findings of its internal investigation. The outside lawyers accordingly met with the government and disclosed their findings, including information that the witness had provided them with. Prior to doing that, they did not seek or obtain the witness's consent. After receiving the information, the government prosecuted the witness and sought to use statements that he made to outside counsel against him. In response, the witness sought to suppress the use of those statements on the ground that the outside lawyers were his counsel and that what he told them was covered by the attorney-client privilege. And the court agreed with the witness. It found that the witness reasonably believed that the lawyers were his lawyers in large part because they failed to provide him with Upjohn warnings that would have let him know that what he said could be passed on to the government and might even be used against him. The court not only decided to suppress those statements as privileged, but also referred the outside lawyers to the California State Bar for disciplinary proceedings because, it found, the lawyers had violated their ethical obligations to the witness. So obviously there's a risk to the lawyers conducting the witness interviews if they fail to abide by their ethical obligations and properly communicate with the witness. But clearly, the risks to witnesses are greater and more frequently surface. Witnesses face liability, both criminal and civil, if they divulge information in the course of an internal investigation, if that information is incriminating. But they also face liability in an unexpected way. If they lie to outside private counsel, they can be prosecuted. Now, this may strike non-lawyers and even lawyers as surprising, but private lawyers are now effectively an investigatory arm of the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
As part of Sarbanes-Oxley, there was a provision added to the federal criminal code that criminalizes obstruction and attempted obstruction of any official proceeding. And under this provision, there have been at least 4 prosecutions of witnesses who lied to private counsel in the course of an internal investigation. And what these cases do is really highlight the significance of one warning that lawyers frequently give but may not think much about, which is, and in addition to the fact that we will report to our client, the audit committee, everything that you tell us here today, the audit committee may recommend and the company may decide to disclose what you tell us here today to third parties, including the SEC and the Department of Justice. That warning is very significant. In one case, the court dismissed the charges brought against the witness for lack of evidence that the interviewing attorneys had given that warning. In other cases, including an indictment filed late last year in a matter relating to the Abramoff scandal, the government has emphasized that the witness knew the information provided could eventually be used, could eventually be provided to the government and used against the witness, and that warning was the linchpin of those prosecutions. And so as a result, that warning is not merely a throwaway warning. Instead, it carries a very weighty consequence to it that witnesses who lie to private counsel may be prosecuted.
So I guess maybe one last question. We have only about 30 seconds left here. So just very briefly, is this something that you think is going to become a more common phenomena, or should executives who do wind up getting a talking to or an interview with the general counsel, mm-hmm. I mean, how hypersensitive do we need to be about this sort of thing?
Well, the companies need to be very sensitive about it because, like I mentioned before, whether or not the company solely holds the privilege will depend on the extent to which they can cooperate with the government. But executives need to be mindful, too, of their liability. And it's not an easy decision because the executives very likely feel compelled to cooperate with the investigation. And yet, when they do, they possibly can be held liable for what they have told investigating counsel. And so it certainly is not something to be taken lightly. And as the government continues its enforcement trends, it's very likely we're going to hear much more about this.
All right. Well, John, that's all the time we have today, but thank you again for taking the time and giving us your observations here.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
And again, everybody, that was John Grugan, a partner at the law firm of Ballard and Spahr, talking to us about giving the Upjohn warning during internal investigations. That's all for this week. I'm Matt Kelly, editor of Compliance Week, and I'd like to thank you all for listening and hope you'll join us again next time.